Welcome to a DerivSource podcast. I'm Julie Schieffer, founder and editor of DerivSource.com. In today's podcast, we're talking about extraterritoriality of OTC derivatives regulation, and we're looking at the potential impact on CCP clearing. With me today, I have two industry experts who will be reviewing with me how extraterritoriality will impact CCP clearing from an operational, funding, counterparty risk perspective across the entire globe. We have with us today Brandon Greenberg. He's an independent consultant and president of Greenberg Partners. We also have Felix Shipkovich, who's a principal at the law firm Shipkovich PLLC in New York. Now, full bios and contact information for both speakers is going to be available in related podcast commentary. Now, starting off with the first question here, in the U.S., the Dodd-Frank Act's goal of ultimately requiring central clearing of swaps has begun slowly to shape the regulatory landscape as we head into the fourth quarter of 2012. So my question is, has the CFTC issued any rules regarding cross-border applications of the swap provisions, and can we discuss some of the extraterritorial implications of those measures? And Felix, would you like to begin?
Yes, thank you, Julia. So the short answer as we're heading into the fourth quarter is that the CFTC does not have final rules on the extraterritoriality application. But I think it makes sense to start off in discussing just briefly where we are today as we are in early October. As most of the participants know, on August 13, 2012, the CFTC has published the definition of a swap in the Federal Register, which essentially creates a timeline for some of the initial CCP rules going to effect. And so let's talk about what are some of the imminent, particularly reporting rules that are going to affect effective on October 12th. So on October 12th, we have the first set of reporting by swap dealers and major swap participants of credit default swap and interest rate swap. That's the first asset class that begins reporting in furtherance of the Dodd-Frank goals. The next level of reporting goes in on January 10, 2013. That reporting must be done by swap dealers and major swap participants who are required to report on equity swaps, FX swaps, commodity swaps. The next level of reporting goes on into effect on April 10, 2013. That will be applicable to every participant, even non-SDs and MSPs, essentially to all other eligible contract participants, and does include all other FX asset classes. So that's sort of the short recap of where we are today as we head into the fourth quarter. Now, in regards to the extraterritoriality, I think it's important to start off the discussion of looking at Section 722, subpart D of the Dodd-Frank Act, which essentially states that activities outside of the U.S. shall not apply to the Act unless those activities are, A, have direct and significant connection with the activities in or affect commerce of the United States, or two, contravene such rules, regulations as the CFTC may prescribe or promulgate as a necessary or appropriate to prevent the evasion of any provisions of the Act, right? So Section 722D really concentrates on two things, right? If we just narrow down the verbatim language of the section. The first is, the U.S. government is concerned about what type of direct and significant connection. I mean, these really are the key words that ultimately drive the extraterritoriality language of the final rules that are going to be promulgated by the CFTC. And two, the U.S. government is concerned that, you know, non-U.S. financial firms, non-U.S. ECPs, who may have ties with counterparties, have relationships with U.S. Financial firms, U.S. banks, U.S. I'm not attempting to evade any of the rules that are going to be required, requiring registration of the Commodities Exchange Act. So the CFTC has yet to issue any final rules regarding the extraterritorial applications. What we essentially have is on June 29th of 2012, the CFTC did issue proposed interpretive guidance regarding the extraterritorial reach of Dodd-Frank Act, right? And just to emphasize, these are not rules. This is just an interpretive guidance. Under the CFTC's proposed
guidance, non-U.S. swap dealers and major swap participants would need to apply Dodd-Frank transaction level rules, including clearing obligations when trading with any U.S. counterparty, other than foreign branches of U.S. persons. However, non-U.S. swap entities can apply equivalent home market rules when trading with non-U.S. counterparties whose swap obligations are guaranteed by a U.S. entity and for trades with non-U.S. affiliate conduits of a U.S. firm. No requirements currently exist when a non-U.S. swap dealer or a major swap participant trades with a non-U.S. counterparty that's not regulated by a U.S. person, which, in a nutshell, if you do not have ties to the U.S., you do not have a U.S. swap dealer, you do not have a U.S. major swap participant, not guaranteed or not having any relationship with any non-U.S. counterparty, you would not be subject to the U.S. Dodd-Frank commodity exchange registration and essentially the breadth of the Dodd-Frank. Foreign branches of U.S. dealers would also be able to apply what's called substituted compliance, and we'll touch upon that a little bit later. Substituted compliance, particularly when trading with non-U.S. persons, regardless of whether its obligations are guaranteed by a U.S. person. So substituted compliance is a possibility for foreign affiliates and subsidiaries of U.S. persons in certain circumstances too, if the affiliate is the legal counterparty. But all swaps are guaranteed by a U.S. person, it could still apply overseas transactional level rules when trading with a non-U.S. person whose obligations are guaranteed by a U.S. person. Likewise, if the affiliate is the legal counterparty and the swaps are not guaranteed by a U.S. person, it can be substituted compliance when trading with non-U.S. counterparty guaranteed by a U.S. person. In both of these cases, Dodd-Frank rules would not apply when trading with a non-U.S. person, not guaranteed by U.S. entity. Regardless of the location of the transaction, a swap conducted with a U.S. person will trigger Dodd-Frank clearing requirements. So just to sort of simplify what I just said, if you are a swap dealer or if you are a foreign financial bank, financial firm, attempting to assess whether or not your activities have any ties to the U.S., I recommend to do one of the following three things. The first thing is you have to determine whether you fall under the definition of a U.S. person. The moment you fall in the definition of a U.S. person, that's the end game. You do fall under the Dodd-Frank registration requirements, and you have to register with the CFTC and in some cases with the SEC. Now, if you have a non-U.S. person, right, non-U.S. financial institution, but it's guaranteed by U.S. institutions, you potentially may fall under the breadth of the Dodd-Frank Act, right? Particularly if you are guaranteed by a U.S. based swap dealer, or you are foreign affiliate swaps booked in the U.S. For these non-U.S. Financial firms, substituted compliance may apply, okay? The third way to look at the extraterritoriality of the application is whether a non-U.S. person must be guaranteed by a U.S. person, right? If the non-U.S. firm is guaranteed by a U.S. firm, then for U.S.-based swap dealers, if this U.S. swap dealer guarantees the non-U.S. firm, the rules would apply also for the foreign affiliates. Substituted compliance would only apply for foreign branches, agencies of U.S.-based swap dealers. For everyone else, such as foreign affiliates of U.S. persons, but all swaps are guaranteed by U.S. person, foreign affiliates of U.S. person and swaps not guaranteed by U.S. person, as well as non-U.S.-based swap dealer, that would not be applicable. Anyway, that's sort of, in a nutshell, how the extraterritoriality would be applicable. So in the last few months, some of the foreign regulators have been quite vocal, particularly the European regulators have vocally criticized the proposed guidance published by the CFTC. On its face, the guidance seems in line with the CFTC's traditional approach of relying on equivalent foreign regulator requirements. The trouble is with the details of the proposed guidance. For example, the definition of a U.S. person is a corporation, partnership, any LLC organized in the laws of U.S. Or has principal place of business in the U.S. It also has defining the commodity pool, pooled account, or collective investment vehicle where the operator is required to register as a pool operator under the Commodities Exchange Act. Right? So here the phrase principal place of business is really worrisome to many foreign institutions because it might capture any overseas firm that has significant operations in the U.S. For instance, commodity pool operators with overseas funds would then technically be defined as a U.S. person even though their home regulator would classify them differently. So at that point, it's unclear which set of regulations would apply and which regulations to follow by this pooled investment. So another troublesome point is the contradiction in definition of a U.S. person. The language the CFTC uses classifies a corporation, a partnership, LLC, as we discussed. If there is direct or indirect, if the direct or indirect owners are responsible for the liabilities of that entity, and one of those owners or beneficiaries is a U.S. person. The guidance continues to then exempt a foreign affiliate or subsidiary of a U.S. person, even if the U.S. person guarantees the swap obligations. So though there are few other contradictions in the proposed guidance, it's an important issue to clarify is how the extraterritoriality guidance will work with the registration and subsequent regulations that are going to come out from the CFTC. The CFTC is issuing a 12-month look-back rule where the entity must use a 12-month historical data to determine registration. There's an issue for foreign entities because if the look-back rule were to be applied, a foreign entity could be identified as a U.S. person even if it's decided to cease swap activities. It may be required to temporarily register with the CFTC, so some firms may decide to just go the route of registering with the CFTC to avoid any potential regulatory repercussions down the road. So I hope this answers your questions, Julia.
Great. Thank you, Felix. Now, focusing still on the CFTC proposed guidance, I want to ask, in light of this or the CFTC proposed guidance, where do you think the Asian CCPs could face issues, and do you think there are any troublesome areas coming up for Asian CCPs?
So Asia currently has six jurisdictions committed to OTC derivative clearing houses. These jurisdictions are China, Hong Kong, India, Japan, South Korea, and Singapore. So foreign entities captured by the CFTC's extraterritoriality application face clearing requirements. If they choose to clear in Asia, there are a few issues to be aware of, particularly if the Asian CCPs are attempting to meet the IOSCO standards, and the IOSCO standards are accepted as substitute of compliance. The IOSCO standards are international guidance and include 24 principles for financial market infrastructure, including CCPs. The compliance deadline for all market participants is December 31st, 2012, so we're really just around the corner. CCPs who fail to meet the guidelines would not be deemed a qualified counterparty for clearing. This means the CCP's clients may need to hold an additional 20% in risk-weighted capital assets for trades that would be perceived as essentially uncleared as compared to 2% of these assets against clear trades. Asian CCPs face some key differences, and there's some issues that arise in them failing to all meet the 24 principles for financial market infrastructure proposed by IOSCO. Asian clearing charges can be expected to be high, for instance, considering that according to BIS statistics, the six jurisdictions in the Asia-Pacific region collectively account for less than 8% of global OTC derivative volume. Further margin costs will likely increase and could cause the spreads to widen to cover additional costs, because instead of netting margin pools across the region, each clearinghouse will have to maintain their own margin pool. Domestic regulations within each country pose another issue, because they're not really uniform across the board, as I mentioned a minute ago. Local clearing is particularly or fully required in 4 jurisdictions, including China, India, Japan, and South Korea. Meanwhile, Hong Kong and Singapore allow market participants the option of clearing locally or in a third country. If foreign entities wish to engage in swap transactions with each other, and one entity is, for instance, located in Korea and the other in China, because both jurisdictions require local clearing, this would pose somewhat of a problem for the counterparties. Countries requiring local clearing have yet to establish mutual recognition devices to allow for this. So this is clearly a gap between these 6 jurisdictions. There's a solution to this issue is to establish a mutual recognition based upon meeting the IOSCO standards. Then possibly these 6 jurisdictions may come to some sort of resolution and avoid some of these issues in the future. So just to kind of recap, there's definitely a lack of clarity surrounding how CCPs will be declared compliant or not in those 6 jurisdictions. Second, if the IOSCO standards require risk to be shifted to the CCPs, then we need to determine who will back these clearinghouses in these regions. There are also capital concerns, as capital requirements will vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. There's furthermore lack of uniformity in ongoing regulations still being implemented, such as Basel III, which may affect some of the Asian regulations that will come down in the near future in these jurisdictions. With many of these Asian CCPs being built from scratch, there's no precedent with how they will deal with competing regulations. This caused problems within the jurisdiction's interpretation of the IOSCO principles. And finally, there are protection concerns. If the Asian CCPs is not IOSCO compliant, then will it withhold the cross-border agreements in order to protect domestic business? I think a lot of these jurisdictions are currently looking at the U.S. as a model for establishing their CCP rules, their CCP documentation. There's definitely a lot of concern that the 6 jurisdictions will not meet the IOSCO standards. And so we'll have to wait into Q1 or Q2 of 2013 to see whether they will or will not have more or less uniform standards. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you, Felix. Now closer to home, Brandon, what do you think are the main challenges with respect to CCPs from where you sit today?
Sure. So let's just begin, first of all, by reminding ourselves that the G20 commitment was to have all standardized OTC products cleared by the end of 2012. That obviously isn't happening. So initially the obstacle was thought to be the onboarding of non-members onto CCPs in a compressed time frame, but now it looks like we're just going to miss the deadline altogether. And as it turns out, the issues at play are more fundamental than the onboarding. There are a priori items, such as documentation, both for Dodd-Frank generally and clearing specifically, review of products for clearing by regulators, which hasn't happened, CCP infrastructure buildouts, which are in their infancy, and the readiness of CEFs to interact with FCMs and clearers in a workable way, which, by the way, begs the question that there have to be CEFs in the first place, which there aren't. So, you know, that's a laundry list of areas where we're deficient or have done nothing, and so we're clearly going to miss the deadline and are way behind. So, you know, even though there aren't any CEFs, there also aren't that many clearers who are ready to accept bilaterally traded products for clearing based on current workflows, and we're a long way away from achieving that goal set by the G20. in general, I think that this means that, we're in a cycle of denial that regulators are stuck in the grip of, which is not a great place to be in when you're the captain of a ship, which the regulators are. And as a practitioner, I can tell you that this is wreaking havoc on IT departments across all banks across the world, and it's undermining the credibility of regulators. The further things get pushed out, the less credible regulators are, and the more willing they are to compromise to get something in at some point in time in the near future. And when that happens, exceptions that may not have otherwise been made get made, and you have unintended consequences. So in general, where we sit today is far from where regulators would want us to sit, and largely that's a result of unrealistic expectations on their part. And that's my view of where we stand.
Okay, great. Thank you, Brandon. Now, my next question, I want to talk about really Dodd-Frank and a variety of areas of Dodd-Frank, but specifically with respect to reporting. Regulators have really focused on a guaranteed access to data repositories as a key requirement. So I want to ask, do you guys see that being the case with respect to clearing when it comes to trying to come to terms with mutual recognition and regulatory equivalence?
Yeah. So, absolutely. Yes, I do. So, I think that the way that U.S. regulators have handled reporting is a model for how they're likely to handle clearing in terms of equivalence, right? So, it's unlikely that U.S. regulators are going to be able, you know, to get themselves comfortable with a narrow definition of a U.S. person unless they can get access to data within clearing houses and CCPs around the world. In jurisdictions deemed to be equivalent to the U.S. And this is something that U.S. market participants should want to happen. U.S. banks want to deal with foreign persons abroad through their foreign affiliates and as CCPs in the most flexible manner that they can. And if we're not able to come to terms on regulatory equivalence, then what I think will happen is we'll end up with a bifurcated model of client groupings between U.S., EU, and U.K., and everywhere else. Right, and all U.S. counterparties will trade and clear through their home country banks and CCPs, and you know the point is that U.S. banks would then lose the growth of the emerging markets. And to me, the interesting part about the definition of U.S. person, mutual recognition, and regulatory equivalence is actually how foreign CCPs outside of U.S., U.K., and EU are gonna position themselves. One argument would be that they're going to position themselves to capture U.S. clients and are going to get on board with the U.S. view. Another angle would be that they're going to completely stand against the U.S. view to try to take share in their home market. Right. So, you know, it could go either way, and I'm interested to see how that goes. I think that the mutual recognition and regulatory equivalence question has a very strong competitive streak underneath it, and I don't think we've fully uncovered or seen how that's going to play out.
Okay, great. Thank you, Brandon. Excellent point.
Sure.
My next question is really much has been said about the fact that there has not been enough work done to spell out exactly how a CCP would be handled in the event of a default. So what are you guys hearing from your clients or peers on this issue? And Felix, would you like to tell us your two cents first?
Should I jump in? This is Brandon. Do you want me to answer that? I'll take a cut at that. So, you know, I've not heard, you know, of any proposals that speak to the orderly wind down of a CCP, and that question hits at an important point, which is that's interesting that that's not the case, right? So why is it that Dodd-Frank is prescriptive, some would argue overly prescriptive, in terms of resolution planning, and yet they neglect to do this for CCPs themselves. But it is worth noting, and Felix alluded to this in his first point, that IOSCO is leading the way and is doing a lot of work in this area, specifically by creating the concept of a qualifying CCP and a non-qualifying CCP. So again, this is centered around making sure the CCP operates in a robust and steady state manner, not putting its members at risk. So a qualifying CCP is a CCP that adheres to the more stringent principles proposed by IOSCO, and as such will receive preferential treatment when compared to CCPs that don't comply with IOSCO standards. So at first blush, we have at least a shorthand to judge who has a high-risk CCP versus who is a low-risk CCP. And ostensibly, you know, we can assume that anyone seeking to become a CCP would be considered to be, would want to be considered to be a low-risk CCP or a qualifying CCP. A couple points here. So the risk weights for a qualifying CCP are 2% or down to zero if collateral is held in a bankruptcy remote manner. For a non-qualifying CCP, Felix pointed out a lot of Asian CCPs are going to fall into this bucket. The risk weight is going to be 20% if the CCP is a bank, or up to 100% if it's a corporate financial institution such as an investment bank. So, you know, I think we don't have a resolution plan around ring fencing a CCP, but I do think we have a workable concept here in terms of making sure that the CCPs themselves bucket themselves in a way that accurately reflects the risk within them. And we'll see where we go from there.
Okay, great. Thank you, Brandon. Now, a lot of food for thought here for our audience here to pay attention to and move towards in the next coming months. But I want to thank our speakers here, Brandon Greenberg and Felix Shipkovich, for joining us today and this DerivSource podcast. Please stay tuned for more OTC derivatives insight in upcoming podcasts, webinars, and videos. Thank you very much.